If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I'd like to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
It's been a really interesting tactical battle, hasn't it? It's a game of chess out there. Those were the ominous words of BT's Jake Humphrey at halftime of the Chelsea-Arsenal match yesterday. Murphy, you know me. I'm as big a chess fan as the next guy.
Of course.
Ever since they brought anal beads in.
Yeah.
But any time chess gets brought up in the context of a football match,
it's not never a good football match. No.
Never. Thankfully, things picked up a little in the second half. And just about everywhere else in the Premier League, the weekend saw goals flying in left, right and centre. The most in a single weekend so far this season. Call me a simple man if you like, but I do enjoy ghouls.
Yeah.
To chat about.
Given the choice, I will always choose goals over chess. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm watching football and not chess.
It's succinctly put. Michael Olise of Crystal Palace scored one of the most dramatic ones, a winner deep into injury time at West Ham. And just listen to his post-match interview. You can practically feel the adrenaline coursing through his veins.
Just talk us through it.
Through what? The goal? I think Wolf passed me the ball. Shot, scored.
Nice and brief, but it was a moment that captured the game, that won the game. And what's the feeling like when the ball does hit the back of the net?
It was a good feeling.
Do you feel you deserved it overall?
Yeah.
Wheels passed me the ball. Shot, scored.
Yeah, I like it.
Football.
You know, there is. You can go so far into rudeness that it comes across as actually pretty cool. I mean, if he'd said four more words, it'd have been God. That was kind of rude, but just that level of not reacting to the question is just
must be a chess
chef's
fan.
Case.
Must be a chess fan. If there's one thing Michael Olise dislikes intensely, it's playing any part in dramatic last minute winners, let alone scoring them. He just likes tactical battles.
No, not for me. I'd rather just 90 minutes of hard work and effort noticed only by my manager.
Thomas Frank showed it. Speaking of managers, showed a lot more emotion after a drama filled 2-2 draw against Nottingham Forest.
It's a very tough game, this game.
Now that's more like it. That is more like it, Ref. Yeah. You can picture the visuals there as well.
Yeah,
head tilted back.
Hair
eyes
flowing
glistening
everywhere.
His eyes really glisten, Thomas Frank. It's one of the notable physical characteristics.
I think it was Evan Fanning who tweeted, remember Brentford's first game in the Premier League was the win against Arsenal on a Friday night football.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like, it was
unbelievable.
Going over to all the fans and the kids.
Yeah,
everything.
Like lap of honour.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
absolutely
after one
brilliant.
Match,
yeah. And Evan tweeted, I really like the look of this Thomas Frank, but can't help but get the feeling that he'll be marred in a handshake, no handshake issue inside the next 3 months. And to be honest, he's managed to keep his kind of starry-eyed optimism about the whole Premier League venture.
Listen, they're still in there. They're still competing.
Far longer than I thought he would.
Also, I like Frank's reaction. It's a little closer to the ultimate feeling that only a goal in football can bring. Some pair of pipes on Gary Neville.
Really quite impressive. How long ago is that, I wonder?
That's a while.
That is 10 years ago, and it's burned into my brain.
There was a roller coaster of emotions at Ellen Road. Jesse Marsh looked a lot like a manager who was going to be sacked in the first half before his boss. I kind of, it was one of those ones,
did he get the Roddy Collins treatment where his ally on the board said, listen,
honestly,
you're gone at halftime?
I was thinking of Roddy as well. I was watching the matches there too. It was like, God, you are in big trouble
just
here.
The raining. Yeah, everything. Just everything looked bleak about the whole picture, but his boys turned it all around in glorious fashion against Bournemouth. Southampton's owners have seen one too many goals in recent times at St Mary's. So they have finally sacked their manager, Ralph Hasenhüttl, just before his 4-year. And if he didn't quite make it to 4 years, did Ralph? There's been stories all season that he's going to go. You know, they got rid of all of his assistants. This is more of a rugby union style setup. That sometimes happens where, oh, well, okay, to protect the head coach, you got to basically get rid of everyone else and bring in fresh ideas. It rarely happens in football. It did happen this time. And once that had happened, looked like could be curtains for poor Ralph. So that's both Nathan Collins and Gavin Bazunu who've moved to Premier League clubs and seen their managers sacked before the World Cup. Oof. Not great.
Tough.
Not great. Unai Emery, 3-1 win for Villa against United. Look, there's a lot to get into today. That's what I'm saying. In case you're wondering why you have yet to hear from the flame-haired flamethrower of truth himself on today's pod, Ken is away on, we believe, an intensive pre-World Cup training camp for a couple of days.
He's buying his Panini sticker album today and he intends to have it entirely filled by the time he returns later this week.
Fine-tuning his thoughts before he travels to Qatar. Gavin Cooney is in studio with Jonathan Wilson today. Ken will return. Jonathan Wilson's not in studio, but Jonathan Wilson will be talking to us. Ken is going to return for World Service members later this week. So if you are signed up, you will hear plenty of Ken in the latter part of the week. Also this week on the World Service, we're going to reveal big live show news.
Wait, it's November on. What could that be about?
It's November and our gang's all here. Liberty Hall shows will return to their rightful spot.
First
in
time in 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow.
As always, members get...
It wouldn't be Christmas without a gang's all here ticket extravaganza.
I kind of feel like that, yeah. Members always get first dibs on these tickets.
Non-members never get a chance to...
This tends to happen. It's just another one of the perks of being signed up to the World Service. So you guys need to listen out over the next couple of days, whoever is already signed up. Non-members can think about becoming a member on secondcaptains.com. Murph, before we go on, the Champions League draw has been made this very morning.
I'm gonna give you all 8 ties on.
Yep.
Leipzig against Man City. Club Brugge against Benfica. Mm-hmm. Liverpool against Real Madrid. AC Milan against Tottenham Hotspur. Mm-hmm. Eintracht Frankfurt against Napoli. Dortmund against Chelsea. Inter against Porto. PSG against Bayern Munich. Now, on... That's an absolute bloody stonker of a Champions League draw.
Yeah, it really is. Just one second. I need the permutations for that as well.
McAdee, hey.
Yador Inchicoro.
Faye Dunaway.
Scotland are a disgrace to World Sport.
So how do the permutations work in this straight knockout?
Well, the winners of all the 8 ties go through to the quarterfinals.
I'm lost. I think the abacus out for this one, as they always say when things get remotely complicated.
The winners of the 2 ties will progress. Ties go through.
No, well, not the winners of the 2 ties.
The winners of all
both
the, ties. Of the 8
ties. See, it is complicated. The winners over the course of both legs of both ties would have been the correct way to word that.
Well, not the winners of you don't have to win both ties to progress. Well, just remember
we are really overcomplicating this. Yes, there's been a tasty Europa League draw made as well.
Man United against Barcelona. Man United fans, well, we should be alright as long as we don't draw. Okay, we drew Barcelona, so there we go. But listen, at the end of the day, you're in the Europa League. I mean, I would say this is not the worst draw. I mean, if you lose to Barcelona, grand, you then progress with the rest of your football season. If you beat Barcelona, well, then it means kind of something. You know, there's like kind of a fugue state in the Europa League for 8 months. At least you're going to feel something.
Conor Murray feels something, Murph. He's emailed in fresh from making his 100th appearance for Ireland.
I thought you were going to say he feels injured after Saturday, which is what he also does.
I think it could be a different Conor Murray. Who knows? This is an email about the discussion we had last week, which our non-members again wouldn't have heard. Talking about Noel Mooney, the Irish-born chief executive of... an Irishman in charge of the Welsh FA. He was explaining last week that the Welsh national team is going to be known as Cymru soon enough. That's the Welsh Cymru. I'm assured it's pronounced Cymru, but
It's like a Toyota Camry, but with a U.
But so we were talking about what we can call Ireland, given that era sounds a bit patronising 1980s
Des
English
Lynham,
commentator.
Euro 88, basically. So I know the point has already been
Des Lynham.
Yeah, he was a great man for the era.
Des Lynham was Irish.
I know. That's what made it so annoying.
Poof, I would have thought Motti and others were Was Des Lynam an era?
He but was an era, man. I mean, made the point, listen, the BBC they have a style guide.
Yeah.
And at Euro 88, the style guide said era.
Yeah, but it's also correct. Well, we thought it was correct, but we did get emails and say, well, actually, era is not the... gets complicated.
Yeah.
But Connor says, hey, lads, while I know this is all a bit tongue-in-cheek, from an Irish speaker's point of view, I've really no interest in a token gesture surrounding the national team being an Irish just for the sake of it, or because the Welsh are doing it. This is Ireland, where you have a significant portion of the population losing their minds at any hint of Irish language campaigning because a teacher was mean to them or they studied PEG in school. We've had people asking the state to just literally spell their names correctly. A FADA is important, and you have hand-wringing about funding and we don't have the technology and op-eds in national papers saying it's time we just stop the pretense around the language. Welsh, on the other hand, has been revived to a huge degree and they are moving towards a fully bilingual population. It's wonderful to see. The name change of the national team is just part of that. While we have a thriving Irish-speaking community, there is not the same support from the state and a much worse attitude towards the language from the previously mentioned portion of the country. Until we move past all that baggage and just let Irish speakers live their lives through their language and encourage and grow the language nationally, being called Éire or Na Sé Chonte is fair or whatever else is just pointless and making a show of doing something while doing nothing, which we are very great at doing in Ireland, in fairness. Gurv Mahagwiv from Connor.
Mm.
I felt the pressure there to
not
completely butcher the Irish pronunciations, as I did the other week. Did I do okay there?
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, that was better. You were just very halting on, but that's, you know, I mean, what are you going to do?
My confidence
would
rock.
Well, no, you just want to get it right. And it's a noble ambition. Yeah, I mean, era. No, I don't see that as being a particularly good idea. But I do kind of find it interesting because I think the Irish sporting bodies have a little bit of a, like, they have a tougher hill to climb in relation to the Irish language than the Welsh do in relation to the Welsh language, I think, because for better or worse, you know, so many GA games happen on TG Cahir, but even notwithstanding that, there is kind of like a, if you're an Irish speaker, you're more than likely going to be interested in the GA, and that's like, you know, a massive generalization. But say in Gaelic areas, the GA is much bigger than it is than soccer or rugby are. And like, so any kind of invasion is such a hilarious word for me, but any like kind of venture into that space kind of makes it seem like, oh, you're kind of going after that a specific market there, which is like completely ridiculous because like if you look at, I'd say there are probably more really competent Irish speakers in the Leinster rugby squad than there are in a ton of GA intercounty panels. Because so many kids in Dublin are now going to Gaelscoileanna. And so, I mean, it's not a... line that you might draw class-wise in relation to competent Irish speaking is, you know, like... That's kind of an interesting topic to get, or an interesting conversation to have, because for many people, going to a Gaelscoileanna is a kind of a class marker. It's a kind of an upper class marker, in a way that that absolutely was not 20 or 30 years ago. So, you know, the idea that the soccer team would try and do something like that, I understand exactly why they're doing it. And
well, the Irish soccer team aren't doing it, we should just say.
No,
the Welsh team are doing it. No, it's just, we got an email idly speculating on what we would call ourselves.
Yes, sorry, But it is just kind of an interesting thing because the GA have kind of squared away the Irish language, you know, and the GA haven't done a whole pile to do that. You know, like there are speeches that will always start with like a couple of words, Oscuelga, which has now become a cliche and almost unnecessary. You know, it's like, I don't know why it continues to be that, like, totally terrible Irish speakers always feel the need to like throw in the couple of lines at the start of every, you know, it's more an under dump.
I feel their pain.
Yeah, it's just, it is. It's kind of an odd one. You know, like, it was hilarious, right? I was like presenting for a week while you were away earlier in the year, and I started finishing every podcast.
I know,
I don't know why, but I just,
because Ken enjoys it so much.
Ken was getting a whole lot from it. Yes, and the amount of emails and private messages on Twitter I got saying, you know, you're like, it's so brilliant, and you know, like, well done.
Well, that's
like,
that's nice.
Well, it is nice, but I mean, it was also like my Irish is terrible and like barely usable. And I was kind of doing it for a laugh, but also, I
but all of our, like, most, the majority of us are Irish is barely usable. This is the issue.
Yeah.
And I think fluent Irish speakers, if they're open-minded, will probably allow for that,
because
there are genuine confidence issues with the language that a lot of us have.
Funny, I don't have a confidence issue with it. It's just a
ability issue.
Yeah, ability, like basic ability issue. That's exactly it.
All right, let's crack into this chat.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
People call them rats because a rat will do anything to survive. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill?
Objection!
I would not give Real Madrid a rat's chance against Manchester City.
You didn't give them a rat's chance.
If they get through against Chelsea, Owen, I do not give them a rat's chance.
Okay, there's rat's chance. Yeah. No rat's chance.
Camavinga searching for Benzema, who hooks it in, the goal back. It's Rodrigo.
I just don't see it.
Still, come on.
I will not give Real Madrid a rat's
against
chance.
City.
Not a rat's chance. It's going to catch up with you eventually. I don't believe in magic. I believe in reality. I believe in material reality.
Here comes Benzema. Sai puts the ball in.
I don't know nothing about being a rat.
Mr. Hill, you know everything about being a rat.
I thought they would lose to PSG. They'd beat PSG. I thought they would lose to Chelsea. They'd beat Chelsea. I thought they would lose to Manchester City. And really, they should have lost to Manchester City.
And what about Liverpool then? Are you giving them a chance against Liverpool?
No.
Over the course of the last 24 hours, Liverpool have beaten Spurs, been drawn to play Real Madrid yet again in the Champions League, and now reportedly are being put up for sale. This news has just broken since myself and Murph recorded that opening link. It's by David Orenstein at The Athletic. It says Liverpool have been put up for sale by Fenway Sports Group. Sale deck has been produced for interested parties. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are assisting the evaluation process. Unclear if deal gets done, but FSG inviting offer. Jonathan Wilson is with us this week. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, how you doing?
And the 42's Gavin Cooney is in studio. Gavin, thanks for making it in.
No problem at all.
What about that news to start with, that Liverpool might be up for sale? Is this a surprise?
Bit of a bombshell, I think. Interesting timing, I suppose. Why are FSG selling? Well, we don't know much yet, but you would assume that they feel like now is the time they'll cash out at the best price, because they were always in it for the investment. So I don't know whether that says more about the state of Liverpool at the moment or the state of the wider game. Obviously, like, you know, FSG, like, they're at risk of missing out the Champions League for the first time in quite a while, and their method of competing with Man City and the other top clubs around Europe was to run a pretty high wage bill. They may not have spent the same in terms of net spend on transfer fees, etc., but their wage bill, at least the declared one, is pretty, I think it's second in the league. I think it's right behind Man City. So, and their pursuit of the Super League seemed mostly down to, they saw the Super League as a way of finally controlling wages. You know, the financial fair play that they cited when they first bought Liverpool back in 2010 was never fully, they would say it wasn't properly enforced by UEFA. So the Super League, well, there are 12 clubs that backed the Super League. Everyone was in it for their own reason. I think Liverpool saw it as a way of controlling wages. So now that seems to be shot down, certainly for the clubs in England at least. Maybe now FSG think that this is the best time to cash out.
I invite emails as always from our Liverpool supporting listeners. But it's funny, on one side of things, they've brought Jurgen Klopp to the club. They've brought the Premier League back. They've won the Champions League. They've been competitive in the Premier League, like almost every season, certainly over the last since Klopp's arrival, bar one. And yet, they're not exactly universally loved. Obviously, the Super League is a big part of that, trying to patent the name Liverpool wasn't their best move either. The sense I get is there's mixed feelings about these guys at this stage. And maybe it depends who comes in. I suppose it's all where it goes, maybe we could do with a change. But, you know, let's see where the sales process goes, I suppose.
What kind of change do you get? You either get, I mean, I don't know if like the Kuwaiti sovereign wealth fund wants to buy into football.
There's got to be a few wealth funds left that have yet to tap into the Premier.
But like that's generally where we are now. Like you either get a sovereign wealth fund that can afford to lose a load of money in chasing these other nation-owned clubs, or you get another American investment fund, and it would be hard to find one who would do as good a job as FSG did in so many ways. They hired Klopp, they hired a transfer, they put in a transfer structure around him that worked perfectly for years. Like, you know, if Man City weren't around, we'd be talking about Liverpool winning, what, 3 league titles. You know, they were one heroic goalkeeper performance away from winning the Champions League last year. They were one disastrous goalkeeper performance away from winning in 2018 as well. So on the pitch, they've been so successful. They made a few clangers in their early years, all right. But that's the, you know, if you want to be really successful at that end of football now, you have to apportion off your soul, you know, and better the devil you know maybe than the devil you don't. And in that kind of roll call of a rogues gallery of potential owners to stay competitive, I thought Liverpool, have to say, and FSG probably got the best of a bad lot.
Jonathan, what do you reckon about this news?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to see it as not being a reaction to what Klopp was talking about with some clubs not having ceilings. And FSG... clearly, you know, as anybody who's not a nation state would do, have a ceiling. And I think Gavin's exactly right. I think there's a sort of a coldness, I think, in that relationship between FSG and Liverpool, because I think anybody who gives it a second thought sees that they're there to make a profit. You know, they're not there because they grew up watching, you know, Kane Dalglish and Sammy Lee running about in the early 80s. They're there because they see it as something to make money out of. And I think they've done that exceptionally well. But there is a limit on what you can do. I guess you then ask the question, how long has this been in the offing? I don't know how long these things take to put together, how many weeks, how many months you'd have to be planning this. But you assume it's not just a reaction to a few poor results at the beginning of the season, that maybe in the summer they sort of realised that, you know, we've been doing this pretty much as well as it's humanly possible to do it, and it's still not quite enough. And in some ways, maybe now isn't the best time to sell, given that the getting in the Champions League no longer looks certain, given that the possibilities of a Super League have probably waned. Although I'm not sure about that. I mean, if the Super League 3 win that court case against UEFA acting as a monopoly, I think that might move things. Or certainly give the ECA, the European Clubs Association, more leverage in future negotiations with UEFA. But I think there must be a sense, unless something's going on in FSG's other businesses that I don't know about, that Liverpool have reached the end of what they can do.
Well, they get one more crack at Real Madrid, certainly under the new owners, or under the current owners, I should say, in the last 16. Is this a good draw for Liverpool at this point?
No, I don't think so. They have such a rotten record against them. Yeah. I mean, this is not a revenge mission anymore. This is now a revenge mission on revenge missions. You know, I think the only weird stat, like the only teams that have knocked Klopp's Liverpool out of Europe have been from Madrid. And the season that they won the Champions League, they won it in Madrid. Atletico obviously knocked them out just before everything shut down for COVID. And all the other seasons were Real Madrid. So they seem to have kind of a hex over them. And also Real Madrid, leaving aside all those intangibles, Real Madrid look incredibly, for the team that has Kroos and Modric still in midfield and Benzema up front, do look the fresher, younger and energetic team. You know, I mean, Tchouaméni and Camavinga, for example, going into the Madrid midfield, those are the kinds of signings that Liverpool should be making. And I think they were very much interested in Tchouaméni, but were beaten to the punch by Madrid. So there was a 50-50 chance that Liverpool were going to get a tough draw in either Bayern or Madrid. They might have got Benfica or their annual contractual game against Porto, but in getting Madrid, I think that's a pretty tough draw. Look, I mean, they might be in better nick come February, but from where we're sitting at the moment, I think it's about them.
They looked an okay nick though yesterday, Jonathan, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think if you're trying to look for positives for Liverpool, I'd say there are two obvious ones, maybe three, but two definite ones. So the first is they've looked better against better teams. So, you know, they have recently beaten Napoli. Okay, Napoli team that, you know, who already won five group games and didn't really care about that last one. They've beaten City, they've beaten Tottenham. So their record against better teams is slightly better. I think, yeah, the danger of drawing a Benfica or a Porto is that if you then lose that, that looks far worse. If you go out the last 16 to Real Madrid, well, you know, you lose to Real Madrid, it happens. And then the other reason is just, I think this draw, you know, football's sense of humour. Yeah, the one thing that keeps football going is that football is this really sort of annoying, mischievous child, which just will not quite accept the authority of money. So Florentino Perez last month saying, you know, it's a disgrace that Real Madrid and Liverpool have only met nine times. Mm-hmm. And for football to turn around and go, all right, play them again. Play them for 10th and 11th times. And if they then lose Liverpool, that is hilarious. And I would have great respect for football if that were to happen. And then just watching the draws today, the fact that Manchester United have got Barcelona, that's also very, very funny.
Why is that one making you laugh?
Just because, you know, if you're Barcelona, it's just a great game, isn't it? It's sort of, I know that the nature of that playoff round is you get good games at that level. Perhaps, you know, more even than in the next round when you have, you know, the sort of more sort of traditional Europa League clubs, if you like. The fact you've got the teams dropping down from Champions League, it means that there's often quite, well, often we only had this round last year and this, but there's the potential for those big clashes is there. But it's just funny that Barcelona, having got quite a difficult draw in the group stage of the Champions League, spent all this money, and now they've got to play Manchester United. Yeah, they've got a really, really tough game. That's funny. And then the fact that PSG, who pretty much in every game in that group stage, just thought, oh, yeah, they're cruising to top spot. You know, 2-0 up against Juventus at half-time in the first game, and then sort of get complacent and fiddle about in the second half and concede. The fact that they draw those two games against Benfica, including the one after Mbappe said he wants to leave, or maybe he hasn't said he wants to leave, but there's all the stories about him wanting to leave, and they were clearly unsettled. They don't play particularly well. And then they're wandering through that last group game, thinking they're going to be top of the group, and suddenly Benfica score four goals in 20 minutes, whatever it was, away to Maccabi Haifa to nick top spot off them. And the consequences of that little bit of complacency, I mean, one more goal across the entire group stage would have been enough for them. Or even not conceding that goal at the Juventus in that very first game. And the consequences are they have to play Bayern Munich. And it's just good. It's funny. Well done, football.
Poor Bayern. Bayern won every game in a group with Inter and Bayern.
That's also funny, right?
Ended up with PSG. No, I'd agree with all that. It's great.
And poor Julian Nagelsmann, right? I mean, Julian Nagelsmann, who, you know, the one sort of question mark about him is that his European record in big games isn't great. Yes, Bayern losing to Villarreal last season, but then, you know, his Leipzig lost to Liverpool the season before that. They lost to PSG in that one-off game because of COVID. So yeah, he's got something to prove against PSG as well. So I just think it's a great draw. I'm happier with the state of football now than I was 3 hours ago.
Wow. Well, that's a hell of a draw that it's managed to restore your faith in football there, Jonathan. What about the Liverpool win? I want to ask you a question, Gavin. I don't know if you heard Ken last week comparing Darwin Núñez as an all-round forward player and what he brings to the Liverpool team compared with Gabriel Jesus and what he brought to Man City and now brings to Arsenal. We got to see them both almost consecutively yesterday, both contributing in their own ways, both getting, not an assist technically for Jesus, but he did win the ball that ended up leading to the corner that Arsenal scored from. How would you compare those two players?
Well, they're completely different. Gabriel Jesus generally inflicts chaos on the opposition. Darwin Núñez inflicts chaos, but we're not sure pre-game as to which team will be worst affected by it. Now, I was listening to Ken talking about Darwin Núñez's build-up play not being exactly up to scratch. If you asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have agreed. Like, I felt like Darwin Núñez up to about a fortnight ago was great so long as he could shoot with his first touch. It was after that. If he had to complicate matters with, you know, a second touch. Mm-hmm. I felt he was really beginning to struggle. But he's improved a lot in the last couple of weeks. He's gone out. He looks a little bit better off the left wing. He's linking play a little bit better. Obviously, he generally just shot with his first couple of involvements against Spurs. You know, it was a good touch in the penalty area. He's probably given too much time to do it. And good layoff for Salah for the first goal. So definitely improving. I think Klopp says he's improving offensively, if not tracking the other way. You could see that Spurs really exploited.
He did mention that afterwards. Yeah, yeah. Mm. That just jumped into my head. Like, there, kind of Eric Dyer, we need a bit more. It's quite intense. It's an intense league for people to come into, that sort of stuff, which means you've got to find a way to work harder.
He does seem, I think Liverpool have bought more potential than they realised, not in the sense that he has a higher ceiling than they thought, but he just has more work to do than perhaps they expected. I know, and I remember Ken quoting Diego Torres' this kind of amazing lyrical piece on it. An incredibly mean-spirited piece, I have to say. But no, definitely he's very, very raw. But I've been quite encouraged by him in the last couple of weeks.
I thought we were going to get through one Monday podcast without a Diego Torres reference, but you brought it to us. No, that's all right. It's another contractual obligation. Jonathan, where would you be on that comparison?
I mean, Gabriel Jesus is clearly the more... the slicker, more finished product. I mean, Darwin Nunez fascinates me. It could be that in a year or two, we're sort of thinking, well, what were all the doubts about this bloke? He's, you know, he's big and he's strong. He scores these volleys. But I just find him fascinating to watch at the minute because you have no idea what's going to happen. And I think the reason that the tendency is to warm to him is that he doesn't seem to be bothered by it at all. He just keeps going. And that's quite good fun to watch. But if you're Liverpool and you're thinking, well, we spent 85 million quid on this bloke, you probably were hoping for something a bit more refined. Gabriel Jesus has had a brilliant season. I know he hasn't scored for seven games now, something like that. I don't think that's anything particularly to worry about.
Well, this is the thing. Yesterday, it was a classic Gabriel Jesus performance. He misses a header where... it's a diving header and afterwards he's given it the, you know, that, oh, I was inches away from scoring. It's like, yeah, but you should have scored. It was for a Premier League striker, it was a fairly easy chance. And yet he was so good. He was creating, to use Gavin's phrase there, he was creating a lot of chaos around the Chelsea defence, who could barely get the ball cleared for large periods of the second half, especially. I thought it's obviously a net positive. Just if he could have continued that early season goal scoring form, you'd be talking about the probably second best striker in the league.
Yeah, but I just sort of think that's who he is, and that's not a surprise that his finishing is not consistent. That's the reason why he's not, you know, that's why he's very, very good rather than being brilliant. And if you're Arsenal, it's probably one of the reasons why you're unlikely to win the league. But you've got that front three who, you know, have got what, 15 goals between them, I think, this season. Does it really matter which of the three of them scoring? I'm not sure it does. And he brings Martinelli in, he brings Saka in, and we were talking in the early weeks of the season that Saka wasn't scoring. Well, now he is. So, yes, it's why he's not at the very, very, very highest level, but we knew that, and he's still playing in a very effective and playing his part in a very effective front line.
I think I generally agree with that. I think Jesus's work rate is insane. There was a moment in the first half when Zinchenko went forward and Sterling didn't track him. Sterling is usually pretty diligent, so I figured, looking at that, I guess Graham Potter's leaving him there just to take a risk and will exploit the space behind Zinchenko. And they tried to do that once in the first half, and Jesus ended up tracking back and filling the space almost on the halfway line. So he's looked excellent. He's added so much to that Arsenal team.
Yeah, Chelsea in a bit of bother, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think with hindsight, you now realise that Kepa has maybe sort of papered over a few cracks of his brilliant form of the last month or so. You think particularly, I think, of that Villa game, that maybe there were problems there that we weren't quite recognising. And I think they're reasonable enough. I think it's easy to understand why they're there. That if you look at the where they were before the sanctions and everything, they had that problem at the back of midfield that Kante and Jorginho, both over 30, both out of contract next June. And I think that's been complicated by the new owners saying they don't want to spend big on contracts for aging players. They want them to be very, very heavily incentive-based. And equally, you know, those two players both sort of thinking, well, this is my last contract. I wouldn't mind sort of 3 or 4 years of guaranteed good money. So that's a situation that's dragging on. When Kante's not there, they don't really have a ball winner, and that exposes the centre of defence. I think that's a real problem. I mean, Thiago Silva's been brilliant since he came in, two summers ago. But in a back two, having a 38-year-old, he will always be vulnerable if he can be isolated. Whereas with a back three, he's much less likely to get isolated. The game against Brighton, even though it was a back three, he was repeatedly isolated, and it was a big problem for them. And you could see that Brighton had really targeted that. So there's just elements of the squad don't quite fit together. Now, of course, had Fofana been fit, had Koulibaly, he came back on Wednesday, but he'd had the injury before that. Reece James being out, Chilwell being out. If you have four top-class defenders out, that's going to expose any squad. You've got the issue of centre-forward as well, that Lukaku didn't work. Aubameyang is okay, but he's clearly a short-term fix for the problem. So the issues that were there pre-Abramovich leaving were then probably exacerbated by that sort of 3 or 4 month stasis when they couldn't do anything. And let's be generous to Todd Boehly and say it's taking him time to get to grips with football. And maybe that process of transition hasn't been as smooth as it might be. But I think the squad needs quite a lot of refinement before it will be consistently good. And that's something that the Potter's having to deal with. And I think that's what's been exposed, those two defeats of Brighton and Arsenal.
Ralph Hasenhüttl, Gavin, is the latest manager to feel the power of Eddie Howe. Hasenhüttl sacked today. These reports have been going on for ages that he was going to get sacked. It seems like he was sort of limping on. He had all his coaching staff booted out during the summer, so probably only a matter of time before this happened, wasn't it?
It's just another indictment of the lack of patience in modern football. And you know, you lose 9-0 twice in 4 years, and you're out the door.
He is a funny one because, in fairness, he's had a
lifetime in that job.
Yeah, I've covered him a good few times on Premier Sports, and it feels like he's very highly rated, or had been for a long time. Has had a couple of some amazing one-off victories against really big teams. And has kept them relatively comfortable in terms of relegation battles and so on. But at the same time, heavy defeats. Like, there's been fives and sixes as well as the 9-0s. And there's just times he has looked and his team has looked so beleaguered. And generally have continued to concede loads of goals. After four seasons, you shouldn't still be conceding a load of goals, especially when you've got Gavin Bazunu in nets.
Yeah, well, Bazunu, did he make any saves yesterday? I suppose there was the one that he kicked away, and I think it was offside anyway. Yeah, I mean, there were some kind of crazy heavy defeats, obviously. Maybe that's the result of how he plays his football. You know, it's not the traditional, you know, dig in, defend deep and maybe catch someone on the counter-attack. They do press a little bit higher, which wouldn't be kind of the norm for sides whose aim at the start of the season is to avoid relegation. I think he did a reasonable job there. That coaching staff is gutted. His squad has been gutted. You know, it's such a young and inexperienced squad. I think it might be the youngest squad, like average age wise, using the Premier League this season. Arsenal are kind of second bottom, which is kind of amazing that they're second youngest. But I think he did okay. I think whoever comes in is going to have a serious job of work to try and keep them up. It looks like, is it Nathan Jones is his name? Who's at Luton? He seems to be the bookies' favourite at the moment. I think he did fine. Obviously, there's those crazy heavy defeats, but I think he did pretty well to keep them where they are. And I think I'm at the stage where I'd kind of be surprised to see if they stay up.
That win puts Newcastle into third place. Ken's not here today. Is it okay to say that Eddie Howe is doing a very good job as manager of Newcastle?
Yeah, no, he is. He's definitely improving every player he's worked with. I mean, Almiron being the obvious example, Joe Linton being another.
Almiron, by the way, last night, Almiron had two goals nominated for Goal of the Month in Match of the Day 2. One of them actually got Goal of the Month, that amazing volley he scored against Fulham. Then scores another brilliant goal yesterday. It's just absolutely, we talked about him last week, but it's just insane. The players who didn't look like they were of the required quality at all are shooting the lights out for Howe this year.
I do wonder if Jack Grealish is claiming an assist on each of these Almiron goals, you know? It's a way of massaging his numbers. Yeah. So no, look, Eddie Howe's clearly a good coach. He's clearly improved these players, but he wouldn't be third in the league if he didn't have a whole load of Saudi money behind him. I mean, I think what annoys me is not necessarily like Howe doing a good job job, etc. But some of the earnest and po-faced praise of him, how he's going about things in the right way, and Eddie is improving things, and like, I don't know, I'm not very excited about it, but he sat down with Jake Humphrey for his high performance podcast. Now, it does begin with, "Now, Eddie, there's loads of opinions out there, but this podcast is about empathy, not opinions." And it's just like, well, I hope they get to the fact that they spent nearly £250 million in net spend. But yeah, look, I mean,
I will say, of course, that's all true. They wouldn't be in third place without all that money being spent. But also, could you say a lot of other managers would have spent the same amount of money and not got them as high as third place?
That's plausible. And they have spent the money well. I mean, I was hoping for, we get about 18 months of Newcastle signing like the modern equivalent of Rabinho, whoever that is.
Over the top big names.
Might actually be Rabinho. He's clearly done a very good job. But like, improving Almiron from one level to another is made easier when you've like a player's got a Trippier behind him and Guimaraes in midfield. And okay, we've not seen much of Isak up front, but he'll be excellent when he gets fit after the World Cup. So no, he's clearly doing a good job, but obviously I have an issue with him being overpraised.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much exactly my feelings, that, you know, we thought he was probably a very good coach. It turns out he is a very good coach, but everything is predicated on the spend of £250 million. If you want to ignore that, well, yeah, he has taken players who weren't playing particularly well under Steve Bruce, and now they are playing well. You wonder to what extent that is Howe being good and being Howe, to what extent is him not being Steve Bruce, who I think by the end had become a pretty drained figure, and obviously didn't go well from at West Brom either. But yeah, he has improved players. That's clearly true, and he deserves credit for that.
And one thing, just Newcastle have been pretty lucky with injuries, relatively wise. I mean, we wondered how the World Cup might affect this season. The first 13, 14 games have definitely been skewed by injuries. I'm not going to say Arsenal have been excellent, but they've been less affected by injuries than Spurs have had their attack lobotomised. Liverpool have had a lengthy injury list all season. United have had their issues. Mostly, I think it's mostly been Antony's in United that have been injured. But they have been, you know, those sides have been denuded. Chelsea as well, like, really missed the wing backs in that game against Arsenal. So that is one part of it.
A few weeks ago, Jonathan, a lot of people would have thought Jesse Marsh was going to be the next manager to go, even before Hasenhüttl. And even at halftime the other day, many might have thought the same thing. Vicky Sparks was doing BBC commentary, said there are moments that can change a manager's path at a club, and this feels like one of those moments for Jesse Marsh and Leeds United as they overcame Bournemouth after going a couple of goals down early on. Would you agree?
Possibly. The last 2 weeks, last two wins have been great, not just in terms of the results, but in terms of those are really, you know, as a fan, those are games you will always remember. Winning with a very late goal at Anfield, coming from 3-1 down to win in that atmosphere. Okay, it's against Bournemouth, but it doesn't really matter who it's against. You've come from 3-1 down to win 4-3. Somerville looks like a really good player, and he's got this nice habit of scoring very late goals. Mm-hmm. You look at the number of young players they had on the pitch, and that you'd say is a positive sign going forward. But yeah, he at least now, I think, is guaranteed his job until Boxing Day, which is a good thing.
That's not saying too much. That's one more match, basically. Yeah,
but it could easily.
He could have been gone before the World Cup.
It could easily turn because. But I know it's. Yeah, you're right. It's one game, but I guess the point is, had they lost to Bournemouth, if you're the Leeds board, you're thinking, right, well, we'll spend the World Cup finding somebody to bring in.
Yeah.
Whereas I mean, maybe they'll have some distant contingency, but it's not an immediate pressing concern for them. So he's bought himself probably two more games, but actually in reality, probably that translates to half a dozen more games. I don't think he can keep on winning games like that. And I think eventually, you know, that level of emotion becomes very, very draining. But at the same time, that level of emotion is one of those things that can really rally a crowd behind a manager. And that is probably necessary, because I think that's a crowd that had begun, well, as you saw at halftime, had begun to turn on him.
Yeah, not the only ones. Tottenham were, but there's a lot of booing at halftime going on. But I presume that, it is funny that Jonathan raises this idea of, and I hadn't thought about it until now, the fact that it's a Winter World Cup, there are a lot of managers who are going to be teetering on the brink.
Oh, this is prime.
Who will get nudged
season.
Off way more so than usually it's pre-season. Everyone assumes their manager has gotten their squad in order and they're either going to have the job for a few more games or not. Whereas there could be a lot of jobs lost even during the World Cup as boards look and get impressed by people over in Qatar.
I wonder, is David Moyes beginning to get a little bit nervy? I should ask, are you getting nervy on behalf of David Moyes?
I would be getting a small bit, yeah.
Because I think there were a few boos after the defeat to Palace at the weekend and he did snap or something in his press conference afterwards. I just read the quotes, but there are a lot of experts out there, something like that. It's just like, oh no, David, like, The European campaign was great, but they've been so poor in the Premier League. Yeah, Jesse Marsh looks like a man who's desperately clinging on for the World Cup. I think that these last few results are a pretty flimsy base, but like 6 points and just like the emotion and the way in which they're achieved are important. Like, lean into the chaos. That's what worked for Bielsa.
Quick one on Villa winning their first game 3-1 under Unai Emery against Man United. Nice start for him.
Yeah, unbelievable start. And, you know, Emery's obviously naturally a defensive manager, but played two up front and bullied Martinez and Lindelof, did Bailey and Watkins, and passed right through the midfield very often. So a bit of a concern for Erik ten Hag, but he had an amazing start.
Brilliant. Listen, Gavin, great stuff. Jonathan, great to chat. We'll catch up soon.
Cheers, thanks.
Thanks, Mel.
There's a winning mentality. I can see it in their eyes. They've got glazed eyes. Glazed eyes. What I said to him at the end, and I'm not ashamed to say it, I said, are you ready to win a World Cup? Because we're in it to win it.
They've got to trust me, I'm taking these guys into battle. Yeah. And I'm doing my own stapling.
Look, we're not getting carried away, but we're now getting to that point now where we are inspiring.
Does a struggling salesman start turning up on a bicycle? He turns up in a newer car, Deception.
So what becomes of you, my love?
Along the way, we're going to have fun.
When they have finally stripped you off,
I try and laugh several times a day.
The handbags and the glad rags, as your granddad has to sweat so you could buy.
A sergeant major spends all his time training his men to be killers.
And make sure that they arrive for meetings on time and dressed in the right way.
He doesn't polish his own boots. The bosses are panicking. They're going, oh, cut back.
Non-negotiable. The way we play football is non-negotiable.
With the World Cup now less than 2 weeks away, keep an eye out for the Argentinian referee Facundo Tello, who warmed up for the big gig by handing out 10 red cards in a domestic game.
That seems like a lot, old.
Champions Trophy final after Racing Club infielder Carlos Alcaraz sparked a melee in front of the Boca Junior fans with his match-winning goal celebration. There were already some red cards before this. James Dart tweeted some footage of this. There was a red card in normal time. There were two more red cards at the end of normal time.
Okay.
95th minute kind of thing, when there was a bit of a fight. Still, that's only three.
Yeah.
Seven more handed out after this excessive goal celebration by our friend Alcaraz, who ended up getting sent off himself along with a teammate and five members of the opposition team who were grabbing him by the ear, apparently. Unhappy with this.
Like, you'd have to say the man has a keen sense of what the fans want, you know? And that's the sort of guy we need conducting the orchestra in Qatar in a couple of weeks, though.
Thanks, Murph.
Garamagadon.
Thanks for listening. You can hear all the pods ad-free as a World Service member. Go on to secondcaptains.com to look at doing that. And Second Captains, the Second Captains podcast, is part of the Acast Creator Network.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.